Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
With Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome. I'm Justin Brierley, bringing you a very special edition of the show today as we launch The Big Conversation Season 2. Now, The Big Conversation is a special series of video debates from Unbelievable, brought to you by Premier in partnership with the Templeton Religion Trust. And this series brings together big thinkers from the Christian and atheist world to debate some of the biggest questions of life. And today we're going to launch our new season with a live audience show that we recorded in London between Alistair McGrath and Brett Weinstein. I'll be introducing them and the topic very shortly. Now, if you want to make sure to get updates about further conversations in this series, including forthcoming shows with William Lane Craig and Sir Roger Penrose, and Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams, do get subscribed at thebigconversation.show. You can watch all the videos there, and you'll receive bonus content and the fortnightly newsletter. Again, sign up at thebigconversation.show. You'll also get the chance to be part of a big conversation recording coming up soon in California. I'm going to be joined by renowned Christian thinker Professor John Lennox and leading YouTube talk show host Dave Rubin to discuss Is God Dead? A conversation on faith, culture, and the modern world. So if you want to be there for that, if you're on the west coast of the US, book your place for Friday the 11th of October at Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa, where we'll be doing that. Details at unbelievable.live. Or you may want to get the combo ticket and stay on for Saturday the 12th of October, when we'll be bringing you Unbelievable the Conference USA. I'll be joined again by John Lennox, and I'm sure we'll do a debrief on the night before as well, plus some other great Christian thinkers: J. Warner Wallace, Mary Jo Sharp, AJ Roberts, Ruth Jackson, Brian Broderson, and myself as your host. So do tell your friends and get yourself booked in at unbelievable.live. But without further ado, let's hear season 2, episode 1 of The Big Conversation.
Well, welcome to today's live audience edition of The Big Conversation here on Unbelievable. The Big Conversation is a series of shows exploring faith, science, philosophy, and what it means to be human in association with the Templeton Religion Trust. Today, our conversation topic is religion, useful fiction, or ultimate truth. The Big Conversation partners I'm sitting down with today are Alistair McGrath and Brett Weinstein. Alistair McGrath is Andreas Idrios Professor of Science and Religion at the University of Oxford. As a Christian theologian with a background in biochemistry, Alistair is well known for his writing and speaking on the subject of science and faith. He's the author of many books, including last year's title, The Great Mystery: Science, God, and the Human Quest for Meaning. Brett Weinstein is an evolutionary biologist who, until 2017, was professor of biology at Evergreen State College in the USA. Now, there's an interesting backstory about how exactly he is no longer in that position, and we might get to some of that tonight. But since then, Brett has been an active participant in a lively public conversation on science, culture, faith, and freedom of speech. Now, Brett is an atheist, but he's not anti-religion. Rather, he says that religion is literally false, but metaphorically true. We're going to dig into that tonight. As such, if you like, religion is a beneficial adaptation produced by evolution, what I've termed a useful fiction. Now, Alistair also believes in the benefits of religion, of course, but not just as a product of evolution. Christianity is not only good for us, but also ultimately true in its claims about God and Jesus. So tonight is very much an open-ended conversation, exploring what science, faith, evidence, and experience tell us about humanity's search for Ultimate Meaning. So will you give a great round of applause to Alistair and Brett? I've really been looking forward to this evening, gents. This is a great way, I think, to begin this series, The Big Conversation, to have what I think is a really important discussion, one that has been going on for some time, but where the landscape, I think, has changed a bit in recent years. Let's do some introductions first. Brett, not many people may have heard of you here in the UK, but I know you've sort of become better known in recent years, in the US especially. It's interesting, I note on your Twitter account you describe yourself as a professor in exile. Why is that?
Well, it's almost a literal description. I was a professor at the Evergreen State College. A protest was cooked up by some of my faculty colleagues. They sent students that I had never met to my classroom to protest my employment and demand that I be fired or that I resign. I thought this was preposterous, that there was no way they could bring that about. I was very popular as a professor, and I had many students, all of whom who remained loyal to me throughout the protest, but I had not counted on the partnership of the protesters and the college president. And the college president arranged a situation in which it was no longer tenable for me and for my wife, who also taught at Evergreen, was literally Evergreen's most popular professor. It was no longer tenable for us to stay. At the height of the protests, protesters were actually searching vehicles coming onto and leaving campus for me. The president had told the police, who reported to him as the college police, that they were not to intervene, and effectively a band of anarchists were meeting out justice on the campus, and this was no way to continue teaching. So anyway, we left after setting up to sue the college and then finally negotiating our way out, and we've been living on the outside of the academy ever since.
Obviously, your role has changed a great deal because of that in the last couple of years. What new opportunities, though, would you say that change has afforded you?
Heather and I were teaching in a very unusual way, one that is not typically evoked when people hear about college professors. Evergreen was a radical experiment in alternative education, and that had many features to it. The most important ones for us were the complete freedom of professors to teach what they wanted to teach in whatever way they wished to teach, and full-time programs where students and professors each participated in one class at a time that could go on for a full year. And that created a landscape for us where we could explore evolutionary biology in great depth, and we could teach to every individual in the room because we knew them very, very well and they knew us. So we could establish a kind of trust, and we could explore evolutionary biology in a kind of depth that just can't be done 4 credits at a time. But that happened at a certain scale. You know, there were 25 students in the room at a time, maybe 50 if two of us were teaching together. And what has happened since we've left is we've been able to take that material to a much larger audience. The interest that was generated in what happened to us turned into an opportunity to share insights about evolution that people are fascinated by with a much larger audience.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about your own background. Was there ever any sort of religious inclinations or upbringing in your own life, Brett?
Well, I do want to correct one thing. You introduced me as an atheist, and although I do not believe that there is anything supernatural taking place in the universe, I don't call myself an atheist. And there's a reason for that, but probably most of you would regard me as one. I was raised in a household that was quite secular. We did celebrate traditional holidays, but the deity was never invoked in earnest. And so that was my background. And when I got to college, well, I should say, I did feel a kind of sense that I might be missing something as a child, as some of my friends were being bar mitzvahed and the like. And I did actually request to go to Hebrew school. And when I attended Hebrew school, I was very disappointed because the culture was not welcoming of questions. It shut down exactly the kind of questions that I wanted to ask about what was being presented. And so I abandoned it, and I figured that was the end of the story. And then when I went to college and started becoming fascinated by evolutionary biology, I realized that there was something wrong with the evolutionary story as it fails to account for religion, that in some sense religion is every bit as demanding of an evolutionary explanation as a wing or an eye or any other intricate structure that we find in nature. And I began to pursue what that explanation might be. And I think in some sense that's what leads me here today.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to having the dialogue with you tonight, Brett. Thanks for coming over and sharing it with us. Some introductions to you, Alistair. I imagine a number of people may be familiar with you and your large body of work that you've put out there. Tell us a little, though, of your own story and background, because you actually began in biochemistry, but as an atheist, as an undergraduate. What caused you to change? Why are you now a theologian?
Well, I think the roots of my change of mind really happened when I was at school. When I was studying sciences as an atheist, very, very clear, you know, science entails atheism. And then, knowing I was going up to Oxford to study chemistry, having some time at my disposal, I thought I'd read the literature about the history and philosophy of science, which up to that point I'd ignored. And after reading it, you know, you began to realize that the kind of scientific positivism I'd imbibed, you know, science proves everything, it's absolutely secure knowledge, actually was rather more complicated than that. And so I began to realize, look, the history of science is saying this is what people used to think. Now they think this. And you began to just get this idea that maybe this is what we think now, but what are we going to think in 50 years' time? How can we be secure? Because it's a moving landscape. Didn't convert me or anything, but it did make me think this is rather more complicated than I'd been told. And I think in many ways that probably it was the end of my love affair with atheism, because I felt it was hopelessly simplistic, or at least the forms I knew. Mm. And I think that really what drew me to Christianity was this deep sense that actually it offered me, if I put it like this, a bigger picture of things, a way of making sense of myself, of our world, and also providing conceptual space for science. In other words, I continue to love science and feeling that this was something that really mattered, but having a sort of framework into which I could fit it. So I'm not in any way hostile towards atheism, but I do feel that kind of where there are questions one wants to have in discussion, which is why I think tonight's conversation could be very interesting.
Good. You've obviously done a lot of work in recent years engaging atheism, the new atheism particularly, of people like Dawkins and Dennett and Hitchens and co. Do you feel like, you know, in the decade or more since you know, books like The God Delusion came out, we're any further along in this conversation that people are more willing to look at things from your perspective and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know whether people want to look at it from my perspective or not, but I think what there is this feeling that actually it's just not that simple, that there has to be something better than this. And I think we could say that the new atheism is waning and something else seems to be coming in its place. But I would be hesitant to say what that something else is, because I can see various possibilities. What I do think is that the new atheism is a very good example of the law of unintended consequences, because in effect a movement that wanted to shut down the discussion about religion has actually opened it up. And I think that is quite remarkable in many ways. I think people like the questions that are being asked, but weren't sure about the answers being given, and the questions are still there on the table, which is why we're having this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, Alistair says that there's, in his view, been a waning of the new atheism. As someone who doesn't particularly like the label atheist, what's been your perspective on that? And I know you recently actually did a discussion with Dawkins as well.
Yeah, I've done a discussion with Dawkins in October, and I had the privilege of moderating a debate between Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, which I think is also relevant to that question, Sam Harris being one of the four horsemen of the new atheist,
the new
apocalypse.
Yeah.
Apocalypse. In any case, I have kind of a mixed sense about new atheism. I was always frustrated with it. I thought it was oversimplistic. It did not acknowledge the obligation that science has to treat religion carefully. It was too dismissive. On the other hand, I do think, and this may be part of my experience as an American, and it may or may not translate to the UK, but there was a sort of an oppressive sense in the U.S. that you couldn't afford to acknowledge in public that you had no faith, that that would be, for example, a deal killer in an election. And it shouldn't be. So there's a way in which I think the new atheists were necessary, that they carved out territory in which perspectives that were not legitimate are suddenly mainstream, and that's good. On the other hand, it did a real disservice to the relationship between people of faith and people of materialist science, because it essentially labeled those who have faith as suffering from some kind of a disorder or a delusion or a pathology, and it can be none of the above. So I'm glad the question is open, but I think it's time that we become more sophisticated about what really is under discussion.
And obviously, I want this to be a discussion where you both feel free to engage each other. I don't have to be the go-between. But Alistair did talk about this idea that Christianity for him became a lens through which he made sense of himself and the world around him. Is there anything that functions in that way for you, Brett? Is it the evolutionary paradigm, for instance, or something like that?
Well, I will say it is the evolutionary paradigm, but it's probably not the one that you encountered in Bio 101. That evolutionary paradigm is incapable of addressing the nuances of being human, and as such, it leaves you with a kind of a cartoon. That cartoon may function if we're talking about insects or something, but it is inadequate to dealing with human beings and the way they evolve. Once one figures out how human beings do evolve, though, it is, I think, a fully satisfying rubric, a fully satisfying lens through which to view human complexity, and it does not force you to caricature. So for me, I do find that lens is good enough, and where it doesn't quite work, it needs to be elaborated rather than supplemented.
I mean, when it comes to evolution specifically, Alistair, you're obviously someone who embraces an evolutionary account of how life came to be and so on. Why, for you, presumably it's not an all-encompassing account of what makes humans humans in that sense?
No, I mean, for me, if you like, it's part of the picture, and a welcome part of the picture, but there's an awful lot more that needs to be said about who we are. I think for me, I mean, if I look at Richard Dawkins, I mean, he develops this idea, he calls it universal Darwinism. And really, for me, it's about taking a provisional scientific theory, which is open to correction and development, and actually inflating it into a metaphysical worldview. And I think that does a disservice to Darwin, I have to say, who was always very cautious about these things. I mean, going back to New Atheism, I think for me, there were three real concerns about New Atheism, which worried me. One was that I don't mind people attacking religious ideas. That gets a good discussion in the way. But no, they attacked religious people and said, these are fools. They are mentally ill. And, you know, that's just not acceptable. I mean, we are very, very sensitive about hate crime these days. We need to be careful about this. They weren't. We also need to be aware that actually they almost seem to have this habit of using intellectual criteria to critique others that they don't use to evaluate their own positions. And really, I think that's something that really needs to be looked at. This idea, if you like, of what you might call epistemic virtue. In other words, you use the same criteria to judge yourself as you use to judge other people. That's a level playing field. I'm very happy about that. But as I was saying earlier, I do think things are moving on. I think there's a growing realization that what was being presented as something that's very simple and hence right is actually rather more complicated. And that, I think that once we start complexifying things, saying it's not that simple, then actually that's when the really interesting conversations begin. The difficulty is that we're up against a media who are looking for simplistic approaches. And I'm afraid the complex nature of these things just doesn't work at that level.
If I might jump in, I think from where I sit, the problem is that people have a very clear sense of what it is about their perspective that's being excluded by the other side. But if one steps back, it appears to me that each perspective has a kind of validity that was not recognized by the other, but that validity comes along with what I would call a bitter pill. And so the question really is how many of us are ready to recognize that there is a vindication for us and a bitter pill, and that they cannot be taken a la carte. You get them both. And in some sense, what I'm hoping will emerge from discussions like this is a new, I hesitate to say, an adult conversation about the status of these questions and what it implies for us going forward, where really the question of whether or not you can be in the adult conversation is whether you're ready to accept the downside that comes along with your perspective.
Well, let's get into some of the meat of what we're talking about tonight. I wonder if you could maybe give us a brief and hopefully layperson-friendly account of how you imagine religious belief arose in a strictly evolutionary sort of paradigm. Right.
Sure. So the first thing I would say is what we don't tend to understand when we take a strict classic Darwinian perspective about humans is that human beings are the far end of a continuum. Most creatures have essentially one mode of inheritance, and it is genetic. We have a second mode, and it is cultural. And we are not completely alone. All of the other mammals have a cultural mode, and almost all of the birds have it, but that's a tiny fraction of the biota. But for those creatures that do have this second mode, what you have is a locale where information can be stored in a non-genetic form, and it can be acted upon by the very same kinds of Darwinian forces that shape genes. So in one sense, Dawkins introduced this idea with the concept of memes. It became clear in my conversation with him in October, though, that he didn't take the concept of memes very seriously, that he thought that it was loosely analogous to the genetic Darwinian process, but it didn't have important consequences. What I would argue to you is that we humans have offloaded a large fraction of the adaptive landscape to what I would call the software layer. Right? Our genomes do not create a functional creature. We are utterly helpless at birth, and our very long childhoods are a time period in which one can discover and basically self-program the software necessary for life. Now, what we do during that time is we largely pick up the wisdom of our immediate ancestors, who we meet, and then we augment it with things that we discover that they didn't know, which is a very small fraction of what we come to understand. So if you take that paradigm, what you'll realize is that we get handed a belief system that individuals whose belief system is a better match for the world have advantages. People whose belief systems are a poorer match for the world have disadvantages. And over time, those belief systems, the narratives that we hand off, will be refined by this process. And so this is so certain once you accept that we have these cultural traits and that better ones will inherently be passed on more often than worse ones. It is so certain that effectively we are talking about a tautology. When we talk about, for example, the narratives that go along with the life of Jesus, how is it possible that those narratives were not shaped by the fact that some versions of the story were more compelling, some versions of the story led to alterations in behavior that led populations to outcompete their rivals? These things effectively have to be true. And so therein lies the explanation for all of the belief systems that we find different populations having on Earth. They are not inherently in competition with each other. They are adaptations to different times and different places, different obstacles. Sometimes a belief system replaces another. Sometimes we have a process analogous to speciation where you'll get, you know, a division, for example, between Catholics and Protestants where both continue on, adapted to slightly different parameters. And so
I'll be interested in Alistair's response in a moment, but what you've described there, in a sense, is this idea that religious beliefs, like perhaps all beliefs of one kind or another, we receive them because of their value that has been handed down by the evolutionary process, this adaptive sort of, if you like, benefit that it confers on the people who hold it together, perhaps in a community. But in that sense, it doesn't have much to say as to whether those beliefs are true in a kind of objective way. It's more about their usefulness in that way.
Well, I would argue that this is not really an obstacle, that in a sense, so what I've defined is something I call metaphorical truth. A metaphorical truth is a belief that if one acts according to the idea that it is true, one outcompetes somebody who will act according to the fact that it is false.
Give an example of what that might look like.
So in order to maybe make this more concrete and to compel you that I'm talking about something very serious and not a nuance, I'll give you my favorite example, which is a belief of the Moken people of the Andaman Sea. These are the sea gypsies who live effectively their entire lives either on wooden boats or within 100 meters of the shore, who were in the path of the Boxing Day tsunami that hit Indonesia so hard. And it was imagined that because this entire population lived on the sea and on the shore, that they would have been essentially near wiped out by the tsunami. And it turned out not a single member of this community, as far as anyone knows, was injured. The villages were completely leveled, but every single person had been upslope at the point that the tsunami hit. Why? Because they had a belief in something called the Levun, which is a spirit of the ancestors, and the spirit of the ancestors apparently becomes hungry periodically to taste human flesh, and it rises up out of the sea and wipes the world clean. That's a metaphorical belief. It saved every member of this population because at the point that the sea receded just prior to the tsunami, the point at which people who had recently moved to the coast in Indonesia walked out into the newly open landscape to see the fish flopping about, the Moken people were running upslope because they knew to be terrified. Right? That is a belief. It's not literal. There is no spirit of the ancestors that lives in the sea. What there are tectonic plates that slide violently against each other. But this belief that some ancestral spirit lives in the water and that you can recognize that it's about to come on land because the sea suddenly recedes from you is sufficient. So that would be
my... That's a really interesting and helpful example.
You're listening to The Unbelievable Show, bringing you the live audience discussion between Brett Weinstein and Alistair McGrath on religion, useful fiction, or ultimate truth. And we'll be back again with part two very shortly. The UK's leading faith debate show is coming to Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. Join me, Justin Brierley, for Unbelievable Live in LA on Friday the 11th and Saturday the 12th of October. On Friday night, I'll be joined by renowned Christian thinker Professor John Lennox and LA's leading secular talk show host Dave Rubin to debate God, faith, and atheism. Then Saturday is Unbelievable the Conference, a day to learn from Christian thinkers from the UK and USA on how to make the case for Christ, featuring J. Warner Wallace, Mary Jo Sharp, Brian Broderson, and from the UK, John Lennox, Ruth Jackson, and me, your host, Justin Brierley. Book your place for the big conversation on faith this October at unbelievable.live.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's show. Very excited to be bringing you the first episode of our new season of The Big Conversation here on Unbelievable today. It's a live audience recording of the conversation between Christian guest Professor Alistair McGrath and, well, he doesn't like to label himself an atheist, as we heard, but he's certainly not a believer, Brett Weinstein, US evolutionary biologist. Now, you can watch this show in full at thebigconversation.show, where we've got the videos for you. Sign up there as well to get the newsletter, and you'll get notified of what else to expect this autumn as more episodes drop, as well as bonus content from the series. That's thebigconversation.show. Well, let's get back to the discussion as Alistair responds to Brett's analysis that certain religious beliefs might be metaphorically true, but literally false.
So Alistair, a lot to think about and respond to there, but I suppose maybe where I'd like to begin is Brett's general sort of way of looking at the way religious beliefs might have come about through this sort of adaptive value that they have and so on. What's your thought on
Well, my thought is this is really interesting, but obviously I'd want to ask Brett for some clarification. I mean, religion's not an empirical notion. It is a cultural notion. What I'm wondering is how one might distinguish, for example, between a religious belief and an ethical belief, both of which might have pro-social outcomes. But it does seem to me that, in effect, in using the word religion, you're almost asking the question, well, what definition of religion are we actually using? Because it's not an empirical notion. And if you look at the history of Western culture, I mean, it is very, very clear our understanding of what religion is has shifted over time. So I'm assuming you're using a sort of generic understanding of what religion is, but it would be good to interrogate that, because one of the things I'm wondering is whether actually a lot of what you're talking about could be morphed into a discussion of ethics. And that, to me, would be a very interesting point at which to begin the conversation. But I'm also very interested in this idea of a useful fiction, because, again, if you study the history of philosophy of science, you are very familiar with this idea. For example, Ernst Mach in the 1890s, atoms are useful fiction. They kind of provide us with a sort of intellectual framework of thinking about things. Now, they're not really there, but this is a useful, heuristic way of thinking about this. Or again, think of Einstein, you know, again, and the photoelectric effect in 1905. You know, he just said, look, it's almost as if light is like a bundle of waves, almost like a particle. And he's very, very careful with his language. He's not saying it is. It's a kind of as if it were. Mm. It's a kind of fiction, but actually quite a useful fiction. And my interesting point here, which may take us nowhere, but might take us somewhere interesting, is actually history of philosophy of science very often shows that useful fictions become real things, you know, in effect that they solidify. And so that's a very interesting question for me, how one begins to determine whether something actually is a useful fiction. What criteria might one use to do that? And obviously I would want to say that I fully understand, you know, where Brett's coming from. He's raising some very good questions. But there is this issue of whether, in effect, one is making a decision to buy into something because you almost have a moral sense this is right, and I am under a moral obligation to choose what is right. And clearly, that raises questions, but it's in effect about truth not so much as utility, but as this is the way I think things are. And if things are like this, and I need to behave in this way to respond to this. And that seems to me to raise a question of what criteria one might use to evaluate this, to decide whether this is a fiction, whether there might actually be something in it. So it seems to me this is opening up some really interesting questions for further discussion.
Yeah. I mean, plenty again to respond to there, Brett. Where do you want to begin?
Well, I would start by saying I'm not so concerned about the definition of religion. I don't really care one way or the other whether the beliefs that we are talking about fall inside the boundary or outside. My feeling is human beings have beliefs. You're absolutely correct that those beliefs hover somewhere between literal descriptions and useful fictions, and that's the bitter pill for those of us with a scientific materialist perspective, is that there's a little bit of faith required to do science as well, and that manifests.
What do you mean by that? Where's, because for many people that'll be an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms. Surely there's no faith involved in a project like science.
It's funny how often a scientist will tell me that they actually do their work with zero faith, but not possible. Because how do you know, for example, that you are not stark raving mad and that this room is not a fiction created by some part of your brain, right? If that were true, if the universe was something you couldn't observe because you were either comatose and this was some sort of a dream state, or you were the object of some sort of experiment where somebody was piping perceptual information into your jar in order to figure out what you would think in response, then you can't do science, because the only thing you have to perceive is what's being piped into your jar, right? So in order to do science, you have to make the assumption, I am real, this is real, I can run experiments on it, I can evaluate what I see, and you know, you can either choose. Are you going to resist any faith at all and spend your entire life on the question, how do I know I exist? Or are you going to accept Descartes' bogus proof, I would argue, and say, well, I'm going to assume that I exist, and having assumed that I exist, I'm going to go on and do useful work, and if it turns out I don't exist or I'm not where I think I am, then no harm, no foul, right? So there is faith there. There has to be. And really the objective, I would argue, for us scientific materialists is to minimize the amount of faith, which sometimes is quite great. If you have a model of the atom that's very crude, an early model of the atom, then there's a lot of kind of interstitial stuff that isn't quite right but is good enough to ask the next question. Eventually, you get to, you know, a periodic table that's highly predictive of what happens when you put two atoms together in certain conditions, and so the amount of faith and the amount of metaphorical belief that's in there is very small relative to what I would call factual information, but it never gets to zero. Our models get better.
In a sense, it sounds like you're saying, okay, science does have to, at some level, involve a little bit of faith, and there's these kind of analogies that we have to go with to a certain degree, but we're moving towards a more and more objective picture of reality with the scientific project. Now, when it comes to religion, and Alistair, I think, raises the important question of how much that ties in with an ethical question, do you find us moving towards more and more truth, let's say, about right and wrong, about, you know, what life, what we're supposed to be here for, what the purpose of our existence and the things we do here is for? Are those the kinds of things that also get laid down at some level the more we know about life through the materialistic, you know, process of science?
Well, very often what I find is that we rediscover things that we knew in some sort of metaphorical narrative sense. So, for example, Eleanor Ostrom's Nobel Prize-winning work on how populations can protect a commons is a rediscovery of folk wisdom that protected many commons before anybody knew anything about game theory. So that's very frequently the case, is that there's a good underlying explanation for why some pattern exists. Very often people don't have access to it, and so they have to... Well, here's an example from Judeo-Christian theology. If you look up the word filth in the Bible, you'll find that the deity is pretty upset about it, and he has specific rules about where filth can be and shouldn't be. And this is thousands of years before the germ theory of disease. So there's a very good reason that one should, you know, avoid having feces in camp, and it has to do with microbes that we weren't even able to understand until 1859. But thousands of years ahead of time, people had good advice, and it had to do with believing that some deity cared where it was.
And in that sense, even as someone who, you know, is a non-believing Jewish person yourself, Brett, you'd say, yes, you can look at why some of those ancient laws in the Old Testament are there. They had a kind of practical purpose, even if it was invested with a sort of spiritual dimension in their eyes. Again, where would you take this, Alistair?
Well, this is very, very interesting. Let me just go back one step. This point about faith and science, that's so good. Because, I mean, you've mentioned some people. Max Planck, for example, has this very famous quotation that the portals of the Temple of Science have "you must have faith" written all over them, because you have to have. I mean, when you're trying to assess whether it's theory A or theory B, I mean, very often it's trying to adjudicate which is the better, you know, of two possible theories. I think that is very important. I mean, I dislike Richard Dawkins' portrayal of science as, you know, absolutely robust and so on, because at times it is very provisional and tentative, and you have to say, well, it could be this, it could be this, I'm going to choose that one, but I'm not absolutely sure, but I'm not doing something that's wrong either, because I'm saying, I think on balance this is right, but, you know, I can't prove that's right. And that's why I think your bitter pill, which I like that phrase a lot. I mean, for me, I think one of the bitter pills all of us have to swallow is this, that actually, as human beings, we have to learn to live with the fact that whatever our most cherished beliefs are, they're going to lie beyond proof. I mean, that is really, it's not a new insight. It's there, for example, in Alexander Pope's Essay on Man, which is, you know, going back to the 17th century. But basically, it is this realization, which I think is very, very important, that you can hold that something is right while being aware you cannot prove it is so. And that, I hope, would encourage a degree of graciousness in our conversations, because, in effect, as I was hinting, I think some of the new atheists think they can prove what they believe. Actually, I think they're just, it's a kind of faith. I mean, when I moved away from atheism, I think I was always conscious I was giving up on one faith and moving to another. So that's an area of conversation. But I think a really interesting question you're opening up, which I think might be interesting, but we'll see where it takes us, is, you know, we're often told we live in a post-truth generation. Now, I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think people think it means that you believe whatever you like. And, you know, what I want to know is how we kind of way rein that in a bit and say, look, you can't just believe everything. You have to have reasons for it. I mean, Richard Dawkins and I disagree on an awful lot of things, but actually, on this one point, I think he's quite right. You have to be able to show reasons for saying, I think this is right. And that's why I think it's very interesting just to see how you can negotiate this to, in effect, recognize that very often we cannot prove what's right, But we still feel we're entitled to hold these beliefs, but at what point do you have to say, well, actually, that's not good enough to allow you to do that with integrity? For me, that's a really interesting question.
What do you make of that question?
Well, I love this, and the word integrity is great because it also contains the root of integral. And part of the problem with this this modern fascination with believe what you like is that people have the sense that they can dine a la carte and that they can adhere to this principle over here and this principle over there. And there's no magic by which that should work. The fact is, a religious tradition is a set that goes together. And we do have reason to believe that that set functions together or it would not have come through to the present. Nothing guarantees that going forward from here in the 21st century that it's still relevant, may even be very dangerous. But we do know that at some point in the past, those ideas fit together. But if you want to pick one from here and one from there, the chances that you come up with a coherent set of beliefs and principles is pretty close to zero. Which begins to raise questions, which is, if you're going to adhere to a kind of faith, are you not then obligated to take on all of the edicts that come along with it? And what do we do if some of those, or in some cases all of them, are now in conflict with the realities of the modern world? And what do we do about the fact that different traditions will be absolutely incompatible in a way that makes it difficult for us to get along in civilization? This is really the pickle, and it's, I think if there's a bitter pill for all of us, it is that once we come to realize that there is wisdom in these traditions, we also have to come to realize that it is not one wisdom and it won't all fit together easily and work itself out.
It strikes me as well, though, that movement that you've sort of come to be associated with, the intellectual dark web, who are asking these big questions in the secular world about purpose and meaning and what are we here for and can we have morality through science or is there something else going on? That's a result of the fact that we are increasingly living in a post-religious, post-Christian West where people no longer have the ability to draw necessarily on the religious traditions and communities that once would have informed their story of who they are and what they're here for. And we're entering this more grab bag kind of culture of, well, I'll have this and that and the other. But for you, that's, people are struggling, obviously, and it's provoking these big questions for people of, well, who am I and what am I here for and what do I do in the absence of one of those grand narratives, if you like?
Well, I would argue that actually we are in a crisis in part because these religious texts are, in general, not really designed. And when I say designed, I mean in the evolutionary sense. They are not designed to be coherent. You can't read the Bible one end to the other and say, oh, I understand the meaning, because it self-contradicts. It's dependent on having a clergy who deploys this passage this week, that passage next week, in light of what's going on inside the community and those sorts of things. So it's sort of like it's actually a lot like a genome. If you had all your genes transcribed at once, you'd just be a puddle of mush. Right? It's dependent on knowing which genes to transcribe where and when. And so what has happened is that the mechanism that has people attending their religious services has broken down. So people are in general left with a kind of vague relationship to their faith, and that is resulting in them picking a la carte. And I see no way that this ends well.
This question then of what do we do, I suppose, Alistair, in a post Christian West, people looking for some overarching narrative, not necessarily being provided anymore by traditional Judeo-Christian framework that many people have lived in for so long. Brett sees that it's not going to end well at this point with the way people are searching and looking to kind of grab onto things. What's your take? And obviously there's some interesting things Brett had to say there as well about, you know, even with something like the Bible, we're kind of like a treating it like an organic thing, you know, genomes and so on. Be interested in your response to that as well.
Well, I think Brett raised some really good questions. And certainly we're living in a situation where questions of meaning and identity of purpose remain important. And, of course, they are engaged by religion, but people are actually looking elsewhere for those answers. I think that's a very important point to make. So for me, I think we recognize how important these questions are. I think religious people are going to ask the question, how do we reconnect with this discussion? And of course, this does raise the question question of, for example, whether Christianity is indeed a big picture. And I personally think it is, although I'm sure there'll be some listening to this who will say, well, no, it's not really, you're not quite on target here. But for me, responding to some of the issues that Brett is raising, I mean, for me, you have the Bible. And the Bible, if you like, can be read in a very incoherent way. Or you can say, is there some way in which we can stand back and allow, in effect, the big picture behind biblical text to come into focus? In other words, it's not simply this text or this idea. It's, in effect, taking them, weaving them together and getting this bigger picture. And so for me, what you have is, in effect, if you like, something which is based on the Bible, but nevertheless gives you a way of reading the Bible, which in effect discloses coherency and uniformity or something like that, and actually gives you this way of looking at things. Now, that'd be the approach I would take. So if I develop it in response to the questions Brett is asking, which I say are very good questions, I would say that, in effect, we need to realize that every reading of the Bible is embedded in the cultural context. In other words, that Augustine in the 5th century is reading the Bible and seeing the collapse of the Roman Empire and is making connections. And those connections are very interesting, but actually they don't necessarily speak to us very well today. So we need to keep rereading, in effect with our questions in mind, but in dialogue with those who've read it in the past and asking how we can learn from what's there. So that, to me, seems to be part of the answer to a very good question.
I mean, obviously, one of the big differences between you and Brett is that, that you do believe there's a sort of ultimately a divine hand at work behind something like the Bible, behind Christianity. You don't simply believe there's an evolutionary explanation alone, if you like. So what for you are some of the things you would bring to bear to say, interesting theory, Brett, about the way in which beliefs arise and why we hold them? What would you say, but you also need to consider?
What I would say is that it's very, very good to be able to identify possible influences and possible causes. But we live in a universe in which there are multiple causes. In fact, it's not simply a sort of monocausal system. It's actually lots of things coming together. And I want to explore what else is there in the mix. I think you can say this is part of a picture, but there is more that needs to be said. Again, this emphasis on complexification. So again, I speak as a Christian, but I don't speak for all Christians, I need to make that clear. But for me, the capacity of Christianity to make sense of things, in my own personal experience, what I see in the world, creating space, valued space for natural sciences, really matters to me. And that's one of the reasons why I quite like C.S. Lewis, because he takes a very similar approach. You may remember that very famous quote from the end of a lecture he gave at Oxford, "I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." That's kind of where I'm coming from. And obviously, if you take a scientific theory, one of the key questions is, how do you check this out? And it's a very good question. And one answer is the extent to which it maps naturally onto what is observed. In other words, what's the correlation between the theory and observation? And if it's not good, you've got to do some rethinking. And that, to me, is a very important thing. So for me, if you were to say to me, well, Alistair, tell me a point of tension for you, it's the problem of suffering. That is one area where the theory doesn't work as well as I'd like it to. But I'm just being very honest about that, because I think in other ways it's quite good. But what Brett is saying, and I think I resonate with what he's saying, is actually we're moving into territory where maybe we do need to keep rethinking. And of course, New Testament is always saying, put everything to the test and hold on to what is good. So I think we really do need to make sure we're not locked into a way of reading scripture or a way of expressing a Christian idea that is locked into a bygone age. And so which traps us and makes us unable to respond to what we're now experiencing. So I think we have to say somehow we can be rooted in the past, yes, but still find a way to engage the present.
And I suppose what I do want to draw out before we bring Brett in again is this question of, Brett says metaphorical truth I'll give you, but literal truth, no. Evolution seems to provide an all-encompassing explanation for why we're here and how we came to believe what we believe. Why, for you, do you think that actually evolution, what factors would you bring to bear to say, well, actually, I think there's other reasons to believe there is actually a God behind this universe, that there is a sort of, obviously, we've only got a few minutes.
Obviously, I'd want to say that, evolution, to me, helps understand how we came to be here. And that's great. And actually, it helps understand a lot of things about ourselves to do with, for example, medical issues and so on, which we could easily follow through on. But then we're also going back to these deeper questions. Why am I here? What's it all about? And actually, these are slightly different questions. And for me, the ideal situation is to have a resource which helps you with how. and the resource that helps you with why. And so the question, therefore, is the trustworthiness of the resource you bring to bear on why. And so for me, what I have to say is I can give you reasons why I believe Christianity to be right. But if you were to press me very hard, as I think you would, and rightly so, I would not be able to say, but I can prove that this is right. Mm-hmm. But I would then just add the rider, which is I think we're all in the same boat. You know, actually, we all live with this dreadful tension, this bitter pill, of very often having these deep moral or political or social or religious convictions which actually animate our lives. And yet when you say, right, show me you're right, actually say, well, I can give you good reasons, but I can't prove.
Yeah. Brett, where do you want to take it from there?
Well, I'm beginning to fear that we may not be able to wrap up this God question tonight. But
I was hoping we'd sort of have a definitive answer by the end of the evening.
I'm beginning to let go of that goal, and now I'm just hoping not to be struck by lightning. So what I would say is there's a way in which I think this discussion could lead to a sense that there's a matter of taste, whether you want to take a admittedly very sober view of religion and the way it interfaces with science, or you want to take a bit more radical view and come at it from an evolutionary perspective. But the thing we have to look at is, let's say that this evolutionary perspective is actually right or substantially right. If it is, we have a new problem, which is that those books are full of wisdom that is not up to date. And what we know, beyond a shadow of any doubt, is that we are playing with tools that are very unlike the tools that the ancestors who refined these texts had at their disposal. And so and I've had this argument with Jordan Peterson too, the problem with recognizing that these are compendiums of some kind of wisdom, well, there are a couple problems. One, some of the wisdom is itself immoral. You know, if you look at the Old Testament and you look at Deuteronomy, you'll find rules for war that are absolutely abhorrent, basically advice on genocide. You'll find rules for how to properly keep slaves and things like this. So those are bits of wisdom from the point of view of how to advance your population's interests, but they are not ethical advice in any decent sense of the term. That's one thing. But the other thing is, because these texts are products of evolution, they are only relevant to the circumstances in which they evolved. So the fact that the Bible provides no guidance whatsoever on the enrichment of uranium is a problem, because really we ought to know not to enrich it. What happens when you enrich it is you create a whole bunch of problems that would be paramount on any actual deity's mind. There would be wisdom about what to do about it, but it's not in there. And so, and maybe the last piece of that puzzle is, not only is it not in there, but we don't have time for it to be generated through the normal evolutionary process. We don't have 1,000 years to figure out what the wisdom for our new tools is. We have to figure that out in some other way. And so somehow we have to recognize there's wisdom. Some of that wisdom remains relevant and honorable. Some of it is no longer relevant. Some of it was never honorable. And we need a mechanism to add to it in a non-religious framework. And I don't know how we're going to get there, but I do have the sense that that is the adult conversation.
What's your take on that way of looking at the wisdom that is, as Brett sees it, limited now?
I think Brett is accentuating something very important, which is what seems to be the accelerating pace of development, which means that the process of reflection and engagement, which might have led to gradual transformation, actually, if I'm put like this, is being outpaced by what's happening on the ground. I think that is a genuine issue. I mean, you and I probably both quite like E.O. Wilson's Consilience. And you remember in that he talks about drowning in information but starved of wisdom. And he raised the question, how are we going to get the wisdom? And I personally didn't find his answer very persuasive, but I could see where his heart was. You know, he's saying we've got to think about this. And he also says that this, in fact, involves people who wouldn't normally talk together to talk together and see if there's any way in which, for example, science and religion, to give two of the partners he mentions, can help figure this out. And I think in these situations, you know, we really do have to think about this. But the accelerating pace of things is a real problem. The other thing which I think is relevant here is this. I mean, if you look at human history, once you understand something, you don't just say, oh, that's nice, we understand it. You don't say, right, now we can use it. We can make it do something for us. And, you know, we understand how evolution works. And the issue is, are we now moving to take control of the process? And actually, I can see some ways in which that might be beneficial. I can see also some ways in which it frightens me very, very much. And we need wisdom to know which is which.
But does the Bible, for instance, give us wisdom on that? I mean, Brett says, you know, it doesn't have much to say on whether we should enrich uranium or not. What's your view?
The Bible does not give us detailed prescriptions on context it could not imagine, but it gives us a toolkit which we are invited to apply to these new situations. And that's why I think this process of, in effect, saying, right, here are these basic ideas, here is this situation, maybe we haven't been here before, what do we do? How do we kind of hold on to what we think are important and valuable principles, but now we're facing this? And there is a sense in which, you know, you have the sense you're entering uncharted territory, but nevertheless you feel that you might not have a map, but you have a compass which might guide you a little bit as you go.
You're listening to The Unbelievable Show, bringing you the live audience discussion between Brett Weinstein and Alistair McGrath. Our first episode of the new season of The Big Conversation, and we'll be back soon with part three. Hi, it's Justin again. Occasionally, listeners get in touch to say, I love what you're doing with the show. We need to have more of these conversations. Can I help? Well, the answer is yes. Creating these kinds of conversations obviously takes time and money, and we're producing more and more video, audio, and online content from Unbelievable. So if you'd like to support this work and contribute any amount, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give. And as a thank you, you'll receive my brand new ebook, In Conversation With, featuring some of my favourite chats with people like Jordan Peterson, Tim Keller, Richard Dawkins, Paula Gooder, Darren Brown, and Rick Warren. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give. Thanks for listening and supporting the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show, a special edition of Unbelievable, bringing you the first episode in our new season of The Big Conversation, a series of video debates featuring big thinkers across the atheist and Christian spectrum. Season one actually had over 5 million engagements, the most popular show being The Big Conversation between Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore. Loads more great content, though, and if you want to explore it, go to thebigconversation.show. Includes today's show on video and, of course, the audience Q&A part two of today's discussion. Now, if you're listening via radio, we've only time for the main dialogue today with our guests Alistair and Brett, but podcast listeners get everything, so keep listening for the audience Q&A still to come if you're listening via podcast. Here on Premier Christian Radio, straight after today's show, Amy Orr-Ewing will be telling me about her life as an evangelist and apologist, reaching students, skeptics, and even the Taliban with the gospel. She's got some amazing stories. You can also hear that on the Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. Next week here on Unbelievable, the scientific debate continues, but on a very different tack. We're going to be putting young Earth and old Earth creationism into conversation. Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis, probably the world's best known young Earth creationist, joins me to debate with Jeff Swearing of Reasons to Believe, which is effectively the world's leading old Earth creation organisation. You won't want to miss that, I'm sure. We've also had a lot of reaction to that conversation between Lisa Gungo and Elisa Childers from last week. That was on deconstruction, doubt and finding faith again. But saving up the feedback for next week as we're going long on today's show. But don't forget, you can send your thoughts in on today's show by emailing me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or do it via our social media. Just look for Unbelievable JB on Twitter or on Facebook. For now, let's get back to the conversation as Brett responds to Alistair's view that biblical wisdom doesn't necessarily give us a map, but it does give us a compass for how to navigate modern problems in culture.
I mean, is your point that you fear whether religion can continue to provide the kind of stability it maybe once provided because we're in these uncharted territories that Alistair speaks of?
I don't say this to be dramatic, but I think we know that it can't. And that is not to say that given many Earths or somehow a mechanism for surviving for future millennia, that we wouldn't get to a new kind of wisdom that was relevant. But I think we know that our problem is too dire. And what I fear is that if Science caricatures religion and does not give religion its due for being honest-to-goodness wisdom handed down through time, that religious people will rightly reject its ability to speak about more difficult issues that we face and that no ancestor has wisdom with which to help us. So my sense of urgency is about putting that battle to an end so that those of us who are ready to confront the problems of the 21st century can do it. And that's going to involve, some things. There are ethical principles that we know are, if not timeless, close enough to it that we should treat them that way. And then there are other places where we're going to have to avail ourselves of new tools and not, I guess what I'm really getting at is we are going to have to violate the sacred in order to do the job that we need to do. And that means that religious people who can see that problem are going to have to bring their communities along. Right? There's a reason that we hold things sacred, but at this moment, we actually can't afford it.
Give us some concrete examples, though, because I think I understand what you're saying, but what might be one of those sacred areas where religious people are going to have to learn to let go for the sake of the future?
Well, we have a problem, which is that interwoven into, I believe, every one of these religious texts is a plan for competing against other populations. And if we continue to compete population against population, we will destroy ourselves. What we have to do is figure out how we can stand that competition down and replace it with some sort of agreement on how we are to interact with each other, which in some cases will be easier than others. It will be easier to have that conversation with Buddhism than it will to have that conversation between Christendom and Islam, for example. But nonetheless, we all have to find our way there. In the case of Islam in particular, we have an obstacle, which is that they are forbidden. There can be no new prophets. Well, without new prophets, how do you update the code about how you incorporate new wisdom? That particular, what I would say is virus protection, that thing which protects the tradition from being corrupted is now going to be an obstacle to it progressing into the 21st century. Somebody has to navigate that, and I don't know how we find them.
Well, this is very interesting, very interesting. I mean, if I can engage with this, I think it is so interesting. First of all, I think you're absolutely right that Richard Dawkins just demonizes religion, and I'm afraid that's led some religious people to demonize science. Well, we cut this nonsense. I mean, you can't weaponize science against religion or vice versa, and I'm sure you're right to say there needs to be, a sort of, how should I put it, sort of hospitable environment where we can talk to each other. I think that's very important. And yes, of course, I mean, religion can be a force for division, that's absolutely right. But then tribalism, nationalism, a whole series of narratives come into play which complexify this. But I think you're right to say we have to find some way of beginning to engage this real concern we have. And I think if you take all the works that's been done, for example, on the role of tradition and human culture. I mean, the difficulty is there is no universal way of thinking, no universal perspective. Science is the nearest thing we come to that, and even then, there's a long way to go, I think. But I think the difficulty really is finding a common language or a common framework in which we can do this. I think in many ways, because we're all embedded with traditions of one sort or another, the question is going to be how we remain in one, but develop tools to be able to talk to and appreciate others and not necessarily see them as competitors.
I mean, and Brett's point seems to be that he's worried that religion isn't the texts that, form the basis of many of the world religions aren't in a position to take us where we need to go next in terms of being able to ensure that we don't wipe each other out and so on. But, I mean,
there's always an interaction between the text and its reader. And we need to bear in mind that perhaps sometimes in the past texts have been read inappropriately, for example, to justify slavery. I think what we need to do is this constant process of vigilance whereby we continually read and interrogate and ask, have we really got that right? Or is this new challenge saying to us, look, you need to come back to this and rethink? And that, to me, is something we need to do, even though it's uncomfortable.
It made me wonder, hearing that, though, whether, maybe the wisdom of Jesus
still has a place in today's culture. You know, love your neighbour as yourself. Love your enemies.
Well, I mean,
and
if you
do
take
good to those who persecute.
I was thinking as you were speaking, as both of you were speaking, in fact, of C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, which came out in 1943. And in many ways, in there, what Lewis is saying is that the danger we're going to abolish ourselves. He's thinking of the Second World War and saying, look, that there is something that holds us together. He calls it a tower. What he really means is a kind of basic ethic that he sees as going across things, sees it as based on the teaching of Jesus, but also wider than that. And so again, you know, maybe Lewis is pointing towards something, you know, a willingness to talk about this, not giving up on your distinctiveness, but trying to work out in some way that your distinctiveness enables you to find something in common with others. And I'm certainly up for that.
What's your feeling? I, to some extent, I feel like you're saying we're at a point now where we have to find a way forward in ways that the religion that maybe did bind us together and gave us a way of surviving, if you like, in the world today no longer applies. It seems that you're aware that there are ethical sort of absolutes, things that we should be aiming towards, and that if our evolutionary impulses are no longer fit for purpose in that sense, and we can recognise that, that we need to sort of take command of the process and come up with. I suppose that the big question for me is that's hanging over all this is that ethical one that Alistair raised earlier, which is you do seem to believe, Brett, that there is an oughtness about how we should behave, this idea that there is a fundamental rightness about the way humans treat each other and the common purposes we should have. Some might say, well, there's the faith, if you like. That's the religious impulse again. There is something beyond just the material world. There is actually something that undergirds it. I mean, what would you say to that idea?
I would say that the problem is that when you study evolution, you respect the products that it produces, but you also come to understand that the universe is an immoral or an amoral place, and that there's no justice in nature. Humans have invented justice, and that it is precious and it is easily destroyed. And the problem is, to the extent that these traditions, which contain ethics within them, are products of evolution, they are potentially very valuable, but that ability to cooperate, which is really what those ethical principles are about, is for a purpose. Cooperate to compete. Now, if we keep playing that game, it will end very soon. So how do we abstract that idea that we can cooperate and come to a new agreement about how to leave essentially an equilibrium, a sustainable human population in which, and this would be my highest ethical principle, how can we give the maximum number of humans the experience of living on a beautiful planet as possible? It is not going to involve packing the largest number of people on the planet at once. It's going to involve somehow backing away from what we call carrying capacity and leaving a population that cannot destroy as it continues to live on the Earth. And in that way, humanity could become indefinite inhabitants. So how do we get from a bunch of traditions that were evolved in the context of competing with each other and driving out another population as your population flourished, how can we step away from that competition and replace it with something that is enlightened with respect to human well-being and the ethics that exist within each of these traditions?
I suppose the question, again, it raises for me, though, is you speak of a highest ethical principle. Now, did evolution give you that ethic, or is it something that you actually believe goes beyond, you know, any kind of evolutionary explanation? There is this thing that we should aim at, regardless of where evolution took us in the past.
I have a feeling the answer to that is going to sound a little bit like nonsense, but every creature that has ever existed on this planet has had the identical purpose, right? And that purpose has to do with propagating its particular genetic spellings into the future. That purpose is served by creating larger numbers of offspring, but that's not the only way it's served. The idea is getting genes into the future, right? Living to compete in future rounds of the game. It's a very stupid game. It is the cosmic spelling bee that ends in genocide. And so what I believe is that we humans are among the most amazing creations of that process that have ever been. We have an absolutely stunning capacity for compassion and decency and empathy, and that our ability to comprehend allows us to take those capacities and to recognize that what we are actually designed to do and what our traditions are designed to facilitate is not defensible. And we must take evolution out of the driver's seat, and we must put ourselves, our best ethical selves, in the driver's seat if we're to survive. And the bitter pill for me is I don't know whether that's even possible, but I do think there's nothing else worth pursuing. Either we do that, or it's just a question of watching how it comes apart.
What do you think about the way Brett has arrived at this highest ethical principle to which any evolutionary processes ultimately
well,
have,
clearly,
to be?
Well, clearly, I'm submitted. Going to take what he says with great seriousness and indeed his view with the greatest respect. But I am going to just make two points, which I think just to show that there's a great discussion to be had here. Okay. Mm. Number one, this does sound just like utilitarianism, the language you used very much along those lines. I don't object to that in many ways, but why that theory choice? You know, there is that issue. And also, I admire this noble aspiration to find the highest possible ideal, and I like that. But evolution doesn't really allow you to talk about the highest possible. You know, it's. I'm just worried about that. And also, I think, you know, David Hume is coming back to haunt us a bit. You know, you cannot move from the empirical to the normative. And so, how on earth do we get this? And actually, if I may say it, this is simply me responding to what I think is a very interesting proposal from you. It's almost as if you're proposing a new religion to meet this new challenge. And I think that's very interesting, but I think you may find some people who would disagree with that.
Oh, people hate it. But I would be careful. It's not a new religion.
Yes.
What it is something that sits in the same place. Mm. It addresses some of the same needs, but it is not founded on the same principle. It's founded on an understanding that what we are wired for is not a good match for what we are capable of. So I do think, you know, and I know I have to say it gently because of the sacred, because of people's what would up until very recently have been a necessary resistance to new ideas corrupting the compendiums of wisdom that they've been handed. But we can all see that we live in circumstances that we have no wisdom for. I mean, in fact, even the world that we were each born into is now gone. Things are changing so rapidly that we couldn't possibly have wisdom that would keep up. So what are we going to do about that question? Can we do something about it while we are fighting each other? I don't think so. So in some sense, there's a kind of utilitarianism here. I'm not a narrow utilitarian. It would have to be a sort of enlightened utilitarian for me to sign up for it. Otherwise, you can justify things like slavery and the like. But I do think, whether it is unseemly or not, we actually have to contemplate coming up with something novel enough to have a prayer of being up to the challenge of dealing with our problems.
It's an interesting phrase to use. Perhaps that's a good place to begin to draw our dialogue between the three of us to a close, so that we can make some time for some audience questions. So be thinking about what questions you'd like to ask Alistair and Brett in a moment. There was one question we didn't get to, which I really wanted to make sure we covered, though, and that is, given that you do think, Brett, there are social benefits to religion, and you're not willing to go down the Dawkins, you know, it's just a mind virus, a mental illness or whatever, what about you personally? Have you sort of actually, do you continue in any way to sort of hold on to any religion, tradition, ritual that perhaps your forebears, you know, would have treated obviously with a spiritual dimension, but you see still as having some kind of social benefit?
Yeah, let me answer that as a father. I have two boys, 15 and 13, and we have been experimenting with new traditions, taking traditions that matter and trying to update them. And we were we recognize that this is a kind of heresy that we are engaged in consciously, but the idea is that there are things we can say now that we know aren't in the traditions that we came from. And I should say my wife is not Jewish. Her dad was a Catholic. But we have, for example, for Hanukkah, we have 8 principles, and we go through 1 principle per night, and we talk about them with the kids. We talk about why the principle is arguably in the top 8. We talk about what the hazards that come along with the principle might be, how you can take a principle and you can instantiate it too narrowly to be useful, or in some way that it becomes dangerous. And our hope is that as the boys grow up, that revisiting these things yearly will create models in their minds that will allow them to actually bring things to the table that we can't provide them. So, in a sense, arming them to have discussions about the central questions of how to be human and how civilization should function, so that maybe when a conversation happens 20 years from now, it has elements that this one can't. Mm.
And Alistair, as we draw to a close, do you think that even non-religious people can, in that sense, benefit from the meaning and ritual that religion does offer, and Christianity specifically, I suppose?
I suppose one thing Christianity offers, which is relevant here, this is the thing that I focus on, there are many others, but is this long tradition of wrestling with questions from within a tradition and realizing how, in effect, the base of this tradition is very, very rich, and sometimes it only finds limited application here, limited application there, and the resources left over to look at other things. And that's why I hear Brett very rightly saying, look, we've got a lot of rethinking to do. And therefore, I mean, for a Christian theologian, the classic thing to do is to reinvestigate the tradition, to say, is there something in there that we've been overlooking or suppressing, and is this the time to reach into the treasure chest and bring out something that is perhaps neglected, but actually might be something that could inspire us to do this? Because I think Brett is right. I think that there's a real problem here, and the thing I find difficult, which may be a reflection on me, is this. I recognize the challenge, I know many will. It's how on earth we motivate people to do something about it. And in other words, do we have to change ourselves so we can respond to this? And that for me is an open question. I mean, Richard Dawkins, I know you've made some very good criticism of him, but you know, at the end of The Selfish Gene, he in effect says, look, we alone can rise above our genetic determinants, we can do something. And yet I always got the impression that what he said before that actually made that rather difficult. And that my concern is that maybe there is something flawed about us, which means that even when we see a real challenge, that somehow we're drawn down by tribalism or by self-interest and in effect don't rise to what the challenges are.
And if I may, presumably that's where you believe there is an ultimate truth available that actually allows people to live beyond their DNA in that sense. In some kind
I think of we have to transcend the limits of our DNA. I think that's what Brett's saying as well. But I think I'm also saying that the dreaded word sin might come into this, because there is something about us which means we're very good at making problems and then not being able to clear up the mess afterwards. And I think that's where we are at the moment.
Okay. Good place to draw together the discussion so far. Thank you very much, Brett and Alistair. Can we have a round of applause?
You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, bringing you episode 1 of season 2 of The Big Conversation. If you want to watch the show in full, go to thebigconversation.show and get signed up to receive more updates, videos and bonus content. Here on the podcast, we're going long today as we bring you the full audience Q&A that followed Alistair and Brett's conversation. That's coming up next.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Welcome back to the final part of today's show, a live audience recording between Brett Weinstein and Alistair McGrath. If you aren't yet subscribed to the Unbelievable newsletter, you can get regular updates, bonus content, and all the episodes from The Big Conversation on video by signing up there at thebigconversation.show. And just a reminder, you can be part of our next live Big Conversation if you're out on the west coast of the USA. I'm going to be joined by renowned Christian thinker Professor John Lennox and leading YouTube talk show host Dave Rubin of The Rubin Report to discuss Is God Dead? Faith, Culture and the Modern World. Dave Rubin, effectively, I think an agnostic, really, Jewish by background. But he engages with some of the biggest cultural thinkers in the USA. I think they're going to have a fantastic conversation there. Do book your place for that. Friday, the 11th of October at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa at unbelievable.live. Or you might want to get the combo ticket and stay on for Saturday, the 12th of October, our Unbelievable conference. I'll be joined by John Lennox, and I'm sure we'll debrief on what happened the day before, plus some great Christian thinkers as well. J. Warner Wallace, Mary Jo Sharp, A.J. Roberts, Ruth Jackson, Brian Broderson, and I'll be hosting the whole thing. Do tell your friends, get yourself booked in at unbelievable.live. Now, I think the audience Q&A from this Big Conversation with Brett and Alistair was as good, if not better, than the discussion that preceded it. Such good perceptive questions from our London audience. So let's hear from them now.
Okay, so hands in the air if you have a question. So what I'll do is right next to you there, Michaela, first of all, and
I am actually Justin's father, so
there was some paternal bias, yeah, in my choice of the first person.
I have two questions, Brett. I listened with great interest to your debate with Dawkins, in which you seemed to be saying to him that you felt evolutionary science had stopped about 30 years ago and hadn't made much progress. I wonder if you could just expand on that. And my other question is for you, Alistair.
Could you hold it nice and close to your...
Sorry? You seem, if I understand you correctly, to accept Brett's materialistic concept of evolution. My question is, where do you feel that man is different from just an over-evolved animal, just another member of the animal kingdom?
Okay, so two questions there. Brett, maybe just to expand a little bit, first of all, on why you said in that discussion with Richard Dawkins that you feel evolutionary theory hasn't really moved much further since his own book, The Selfish Gene, in the 1970s, and how that ties into what we've been talking about tonight.
So, in some sense, I think this is just strictly an empirical question. If I ask my colleagues what scientific progress has been made on the study of evolution in the period since 1976, what I get back is a long list of empirical studies. And when I say, what is the last theoretical breakthrough on which we all agree? Silence. So I have the sense that we just simply know that progress has stopped. And when I asked Dawkins why he thought that was, his answer tells me that there's actually something deep down this road. What he told me is that he thought that more or less his generation had gotten all of the big stuff right, and so that one would expect a kind of cessation of progress. And what I know from my own work is that that's not true, because there are a great many questions that we can't yet answer. Big questions, like about the nature of sexual selection, what we call lekking, about speciation. These big questions have simply moved into another phase where we've stopped asking them and embarrassing ourselves because we can't answer the question. Why, for example, are there more species more densely packed as one moves from the poles to the equator? That's a question we should be able to answer. It's repeated on every continent, in every ocean, at every depth. So why can't we answer it? Because we've lost the thread of the conversation, not because we answered all the questions. So in some sense, progress seems to have stopped. Why it stopped, we can argue about, but that we should do something to jumpstart it, I think, is almost beyond question.
Okay. And the second question was, to what extent does your view mean that humanity is not simply another over-evolved animal, because you go along with a great deal, obviously, of what Brett views as the evolutionary history of the Earth.
Yes, and as I made very clear, that's part of the picture, but I think there's more to it than that. I wouldn't describe myself as a materialist or even a naturalist. I think I'd want to qualify both of those. But I think you have to realise is that in this fascinating conversation, we cannot cover everything. Mm-hmm. And certainly if I didn't register disagreement with Brett on that, maybe it's because that didn't really emerge as a conversation item. I think perhaps there are others which were higher up the food chain than that one.
In a sense, though, I assume you obviously do have a belief that within humanity there's something more than just the evolutionary process going on.
I would say that. Brett made a very interesting comment. He used the word supernatural. Many of you won't know this, but I'm interested in intellectual history. The word supernatural was first used in the year 1170. So if it wasn't used before then, what does that say about the description we're using, for example, to refer to belief in God? Why suddenly does this become supernatural when it wasn't before then? So I want to say we need new vocabulary to get this right. I don't think a natural versus supernatural does it very well. What I would say is it seems to me there is something about human nature which makes it perceptive to or attentive to something that is so easily missed. And if you want me to give you a lecture on this, I talk about the idea of the image of God. But maybe that's for another occasion.
Okay.
Can I try a one-word answer to your question about what makes human beings
go ahead.
Special and very different from every other animal? Language. That's it. Everything follows from that. The big brain, everything else, it follows from what we can convey with language that no other animal can.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Let's go perhaps from this side this time. Heather, if you'd like to pass it to the gentleman. Yep, just in front of you with his hand up there.
Great discussion and really kind of respectful of each other's views, which is great to hear. And actually, a lot of common ground. I think you well laid out your understanding of how knowledge comes about and the complexity of it and how it moves forward. And yet, question to both of you, you both seem to have reached quite simple and perhaps more important, completed conclusions. Brett's that, as I understand it, that there is no deity, and Alistair's that the ultimate revelation of reality, and I stress the ultimate bit, was completed in first century Palestine. And, you know, and in some ways, the complexity of what you laid out and your simple conclusions seem to be a bit at odds with each other, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
So have we arrived at our conclusions prematurely, perhaps, given what the fact that we are obviously limited, still so much we don't know about the universe, about, you know, the nature of reality? Do you want to start this one off?
Sure. I think this has... The answer lies in the way complexity actually comes to exist and the way emergence comes to exist. So if you think about what Darwin went through in order to figure out the theory of natural selection, it was a very long trajectory. And if you look at his notes and his writings, it's a very elaborate argument that we can now sum up in a couple of sentences. Are those sentences perfectly accurate? They're accurate. They're not precise. But they're good enough to make progress up to some level, at which point their lack of precision requires some new nuance that we don't have. So what I think you're hearing from me, at least, is those very simple ideas that I'm expressing, I'm not of the belief that they are precise. I am of the belief that they are good enough for us to do the work that we have to do. And at the point that they peter out, I don't want us to forget that there was a lack of precision that then has to be picked up. But for the moment, I think they are good enough, and the questions are right in front of us on the basis of what we do understand pretty well.
And in that sense, when you look at the evolutionary paradigm yourself, Brett, you don't think it's going to be overthrown by anything. It's just going to be tweaked, moderated, complemented by other things. But what we've got at its core, that's going to be with us forever.
Not the 1976 version.
Okay.
So you have to be more serious about Dawkins' meme idea than Dawkins is. Once you realize what the implications are of mimetic evolution, and more importantly, that mimetic evolution has a very specific relationship to genetic evolution, once you see that, you begin to be able to understand how human beings function. Until you see it, or if you're vague about it, or agnostic about that relationship, it doesn't work. But once you see it, suddenly human beings become a tractable evolutionary phenomenon, and you see the rest of this puzzle with a great deal of clarity. So I think that's where we are, is that we need that next little update on Dawkins' theory of memes, and from there, we have a very solid grounding to deal with human beings, and then at some point it will not be good enough and we'll have to add to it.
I'd just be interested in your response to that idea that, you know, we need to adjust and take the focus off
I think this is a very interesting question. But you know, if you've read someone like Thomas Kuhn, Structure Scientific Revolutions, you have this feeling, look, that there comes a point where a science reaches a point where either it's going to get it right or it realizes this isn't going to work. And the question is, when does the scientific community say we need to do some rethinking? Now, I am not in any way qualified to comment on this. But for me, a science that hasn't kind of way progressed much in the last 40 years, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, is there a better paradigm waiting to be discovered? But you're all thinking that anyway, so you don't need me to tell you that.
No, the problem of us becoming conservative within a science and not making further progress is a dire problem. That is exactly where we are. And so there's a...
Without wishing anything on anyone, are we waiting for an old guard, as it were, to pass away before a new paradigm is going to emerge?
I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember exactly who it was. It may have been Bohr who said, science progresses funeral by funeral. Right? That's where we are. And, you know, I'm not wishing anybody dead, but I am wishing that we could move past some of the ideas that got us through the 70s and jumpstart the process of asking deep questions again.
Okay, thank you very much.
Haven't answered the question.
Oh, yes,
question.
Of course. So there's the question of...
Yes, I mean, basically, yes, I mean, I would say Jesus is great, wonderful, but there is this ongoing process of reflecting on who he is, what he matters so much, and how he impacts on us today. In other words, I can't just reach into the past and say, look, in 1600 said this, that does it. You know, it's always an ongoing process of reflection. How does this challenge me, resource me, motivate me today with these issues? So if you like, it's a constant process of reflection on Scripture and asking how do I respond to these issues. So yes, that's where the focus is, but the application is always in terms of trying to engage the present in light of this rich resource we have.
Thank you. Really helpful question, actually. Okay, let's go more towards the middle on over here. If you could pass it along to... yes, the gentleman there with the beard, and then we'll go further on.
Great talk, thanks guys. So Alistair, at the beginning of your talk you mentioned that the history of philosophy of science elucidates the fact that scientific theories often change over time, and this might give us reason to not want to hinge our worldview on the scientific method. Considering that, and the fact that your worldview hinges on Christianity, my question is, are you not troubled with a God who is more concerned about the mixed fabrics and consumption of shellfish than he is about humans owning other humans? Now, I'm not particularly interested in the answer that Jesus brought the New Testament and this supersedes the old, because to my understanding, Christians believe in objective morality. And if God changes his mind, why should I have any confidence that he won't, that what he's told me that is true today won't change in the near future?
Okay, so I don't know if you caught all of that.
I caught that, yes. I can respond to that, yes.
Go ahead.
Well, Christians read the Old Testament, as you will know, in the light of the idea there's a new dispensation. And it's not a question of God changing his mind. A writer like Irenaeus, for example, in the second century, would say that what we see in the Old Testament is a morality, a cultic way of behaving, which is appropriate to that dispensation. But the reason Irenaeus is so clear we have to move on is that we're in a new testament, a new covenant, and that means there are a new set of rules. And although, of course, he carries over the Ten Commandments, he's very clear that Old Testament cultic laws don't apply anymore. So that would be absolutely characteristic of Christianity, that in effect we do not regard, for example, Old Testament dietary laws or food regulations as being of any significance at all, and indeed would see that as being validated by what Jesus himself said. So in terms of my personal dietary habits, you know, all foods are declared clean, so I can eat what I like, but I then exercise additional judgments on what I personally think are appropriate, given, for example, various ecological, environmental, and economic issues, which seem to me to be very important. So that's how I'd respond to that particular point.
Did you want to add anything, Brett?
Well, I would say I think the dietary laws are a perfect example of why or how it is that we know that we need to update, because to the extent that these are good enough to protect you from something at some point in the distant past, we also know that we have hazards now that we are incapable of protecting ourselves from. So, for example, pesticide residue on food should be a primary concern. To the extent that there was a new set of kosher laws, they would involve how we treat food so that we don't end up ingesting these dangerous compounds for which we are not evolutionarily prepared. And the absence of that wisdom and the absence of a mechanism to introduce that wisdom tells me that we are in a phase where, unfortunately, we're going to have to navigate this outside of the structures that would once have protected us from dangerous foods.
But would you say, Alistair, that your faith still has something to say to those very modern incarnations of, you know, dietary issues and that sort of a thing?
Well, you read something like Mary Douglas. I mean, saying, look, there's a lot of sense in this. Mm. It's just that the element of obligation's been removed. It's now something which I may do, I may not do it. In fact, like, the responsibility's been shifted to me. But it is this idea that you've moved away from these particular regulations just seen as specific to a particular period in cultic history, and we're now in a different period. But nevertheless, that does not mean that we just eat what we want. There are these ethical decisions we have to make. So if you like, there's nothing being ruled out, but you and I have to make additional decisions about what we actually do.
Okay, let's have some more questions. Perhaps we'll try and go more towards the middle, Heather. There's a gentleman... you've all got your hands up, but if you keep it passing along, yeah, to the gentleman in the waistcoat, I think. Okay.
Thank you. I guess a question for you, Brett. I wondered what the adaptive benefits of being a follower of Jesus was in first century Roman ruled Jerusalem.
That's a great question. So, and well put, I think. So, given that in its time, Christianity was, in a sense, a minority, very strange, in a sense, in that cultural religion, for which people got persecuted and killed, what were the evolutionary benefits of becoming a Christian?
This is a really good question. Obviously, it was a long shot bet that worked out. And the question is, how many... Well, that's what they are. Well, if you want to know what these things look like, I would recommend a book called The Kingdom of Matthias about a contemporary and de facto competitor of Joseph Smith's at the point that Mormonism was founded. This guy never had more than 30 followers, and his sect died out completely. But in some sense, if you had been there for these two guys jousting over acquiring followers, you wouldn't necessarily have known who to bet on. So the problem for us is that we have the story of the remarkable success. The ideas that Jesus apparently was spreading have caught fire, they've taken over a large part of the globe, and so looking backwards, we know that that one worked out, and you think, how could it possibly have? But what you don't have, due to what we would call survivor bias, is all the stories of things that looked equally promising that left no imprint that we can detect from this place in history. So anyway, beware survivor bias. It is a very powerful force.
So to toss it to you, Alistair, what do you think of this idea that, yeah, Christianity survived because it kind of was the one that got lucky and caught on?
Well, I think the early Christians thought this is right. We have to do this. This is something that we feel morally impelled to do. And the survival survival rates weren't very encouraging. And I think that we have to respect that. Actually, it is a very important reminder that while I have no doubt that one factor that might encourage somebody to adopt a particular worldview is the social benefits it brings, it's actually quite difficult to identify social benefits for early Christianity apart from the sense of solidarity they felt with themselves and, as you will know, the sense of solidarity they felt with the suffering Christ. If you go into the catacombs, you know, what you will see is one of the dominant images is of Christ as the good shepherd who is carrying these lambs. In other words, there's someone who's with you while you suffer. So I think that that's a very important question to kind of way help us refocus on a very important discussion.
Thank you very much. Okay, more hands going up. Let's perhaps come down to the front, if that's all right, Michaela. And let's pass it along to the middle, and this gentleman here in the dark sweater, if you'd like to ask a question.
Thanks so much for coming tonight, both of you. It's been great. So, Brett, my question is for you. How important do you think that specifically belief in God or God's deity is to the usefulness of religion? So, apart from... So, if you took God out of the picture, the belief in a deity, if it was just the principles, morals and values that have been passed down, would we have benefited just as much?
So what part does the deity part,
yeah,
the belief in God play,
yeah,
as opposed to just the right moral framework and,
yeah, have
rules
we benefited
and so on?
In spite of the belief in God? You know, so going forward, can we come up with a framework that doesn't involve a deity of some kind? Will that be just as effective?
Very insightful question. So the problem is that the deity, I mean, you're going to have to accept my terminology here, which is going to be sacrilegious, and I apologize for that. But the deity is a hack, right? It hacks a structure in a way that functions. So if one, let's just take a trivial example or a semi-trivial example. Do you take the money out of the cash register if you're pretty sure nobody's going to see you do it, but you're not entitled to it, right? One could say, well, if there's a 1 in 100 chance of my getting caught and the amount of money is sufficient in the cash register to change my state in the world for the next week, maybe it's worth it, right? Well, if you make that decision each and every time the equivalent of a cash register is left open to you, then you will eventually run afoul of the odds. Somebody will catch you, and you will experience a spectacular catastrophe for your reputation, which will cost you way more than you ever got out of any open cash register. So that's a bit of statistics that you need to understand, and you need to understand what economists would call expected return. So the expected return is very low on the cash register because of the spectacular cost the one time you get caught in however many instances. So how do you convey that efficiently so that people get the statistical lesson without having to take the statistics class? Well, you say you can't get away with taking it out of the cash register because there's somebody who cares and he's watching you, and as you take it, he sees it, and boy, is that going to come back to haunt you. So that metaphor correctly hacks your model for whether this is a good idea in a way that is actually in your interests. Now, can you, if you are aware, and again, this is my viewpoint, if you are aware that there's nobody up there actually watching, write a code that is equally effective at getting people not to behave in this way? That's going to be tough. On the other hand, I'm not sure we have a choice. I think we have to figure out how to pass on this kind of insight in a way that does not depend on unfalsifiable belief structures.
I'm going to toss it to Alistair as well in a moment, but the question that occurred to me on hearing that, which is a fascinating way of putting it, Brett, is what you're then saying is that the reason we develop the belief that it's wrong to take money from someone else in that way is because it's ultimately not in our best interests in terms of our evolutionary future, rather than it's actually wrong to do that stuff.
So those two things converge,
okay,
right? So there is an absolute wrong about it, and what one wants is for us to take on the responsibility for not doing it because it is wrong. But how does it become wrong? How do we learn that it is wrong? These things are induced in us through a mechanism. You know, in Catholicism, the fact that you do wrong and that wrong counts against you in a way that you can relieve yourself of the debt, but you have to confess it to somebody who's then in a position to give guidance to you and others, that, again, it's a hack. It correctly teaches you that this is wrong through some mechanism that has to be instantiated in the real world, and it can be done through metaphor. It must be done now through insight and enlightenment, and that's not going to be easy.
What's your take on this idea that God is a sort of a hack to get us to the right sort of answer, but one that's, you know, a useful fiction in that sense?
I think I would say God is creator, and that kind of way moves us in a very different direction. I think there are two things I'd want to say. One is that I think that one of the significant things about believing in a righteous God is this deep sense that when society goes very, very badly wrong, there is something against which we are being judged. And if you look at, for example, Germany during the late 1930s, you see a resurgence of the kind of approach you and I probably call natural law. In other words, look, the law is being rigged to, in effect, do all these things. There has to be somebody above this who's able to say, this is not right. And so there's a very deep, I think, sense that we need something which is able to say to us, yes, we created these laws, but actually they are flawed. But I think the more positive point I'd want to make is this. I think that there's a lot of reason to think that we as human beings are trying to see how we fit into a bigger picture. You might think of Crystal Park and others in Chicago doing work on this. But what is interesting is this. If you articulate that in terms of God, then in effect you are fitting into a bigger picture, which actually gives you a sense of who you are, what the whole point of things is. And actually, I don't know if you've read Salman Rushdie's grant a lecture at Cambridge called Is Nothing Sacred? It's very short. Now, if you read that, he's not expressing total commitment to belief in God, but he figures out that there's something it's saying. Two things. Number one, that God is the repository for our sense of amazement and wonder, which makes us realize that there's something bigger and we're part of it. And then secondly, and really importantly, he says, that there's something about human nature, which means that a purely, he used the word secular, that needs passing, but you can see he's getting at, a purely secular worldview actually is not going to satisfy, because there's something about us that is looking for something deeper. So I think that's how I'd want to begin to answer the question, but as you can see, there's a lot more that needs to be said.
Okay, thank you very much for the question. Let's go up to the back. Heather, would you like to take it up, and there's someone right at the back there. Let's go to the person, yeah, that's being pointed to just here. Thank you.
Thank you for a very interesting discussion. Obviously, as a humanist, I find myself agreeing a lot with what Brett said, but. And to me, the other thing that comes over from you is in fact, this vast area of common ground in terms of shared values. But I suppose my question really is to Alistair, which is about this issue of scripture. And the difficulty I have with scripture is it privileges the writings of thinkers 2,000 years ago over the writings and thoughts of thinkers living today or at any time between now and then. And the effect of that seems to be too often that what people feel obliged to do is to find ways past the mistakes. You know, it seems, and I would imagine from what you said you agree with this, that, you know, that LGBT people should be treated with respect and equality and so on. But the scripture doesn't say that. It says that they're great sinners. So people then have to read the scripture and put a lot of energy into finding out a way past it. So rather than a repository of wisdom, it seems from the outside as though it's a repository of problems when there may be other sources of information, you know, other writings which are more helpful. So could you say in what way the scriptures actually will benefit the wider conversation and get past these problematic areas?
Well, I think that's a good question to try and answer. I think that every text does reflect its cultural environment to some extent, and that affects basically the questions it raises, and also, I suppose, partly the answers given. I mean, if you read Richard Dawkins' God Delusion, I mean, it's only, what now, 10, 15 years old, but already it's very much showing its age, and his rather banal platitudes at the back, you know, really have not stood the test of time well. So when we go back to Scripture, I mean, what I think we see there is this. This is, in effect, about how God revealed himself in this way at this time, and which Christians see as being, in effect, paradigmatic or normative or having some sort of authority for how we think about these things now. And there's always this question. We read this text. How do we, in effect, bridge the gap between the text and where we are now? And obviously it is a problematic process in some ways, as you've suggested. And the question really is, how do we, in effect, determine some basic principles, try and apply them in new situations, very often situations that are changing very rapidly indeed. And that's why what I'd want to say is, you ask about what other texts are there. I mean, for Christians, there would always be this question of there being Christian writers. I mentioned C.S. Lewis. We can give a long list of our Christian history who are constantly saying, here is the Bible, here is where we are now. Let's try and ensure we are articulating this in a way that connects up with where we are today. And that seems to me to be the beginnings of an answer to your question. And obviously, we are anyone who writes a text, for example, I'm not sure how Richard Dawkins' God Delusion will be received in 100 years' time, because things are going to have changed any further. But I think it does give you this long tradition of wrestling with texts, which actually enables you to bring them to bear on new translation, new situations. Let me give you an example. It is certainly true that Christian theologians take the Bible very, very seriously. But take John Calvin in Geneva during the 16th century, reading the Old Testament, which forbids usury, as you will know, and saying, well, look, I'm sorry, that really belonged to an early period in history. We're now in 16th century Geneva, and we can see what the problem of usury was, and if we fix the rate of interest, that actually addresses the concern that lay behind biblical texts. So the methodology used by Calvin there is to say, I see what the underlying principle was, therefore, to maintain that, I can actually apply it in a different way in this context. So I think it's very important to keep asking these questions, and I think it's very important to do that. But we also need to bear in mind that actually human moral conventions change massively over time, and there's always going to be this question of how we engage with a rapidly changing situation. And Brett has made a point, which I think is relevant to all of us, which is that it takes time to reflect on these developments and work out how best to respond to them. And very often the lag between reflection and where we are actually is moving so quickly that sometimes it's difficult to actually quite keep catching up.
It's obviously keys in what you've been talking about. We need to update. The old text can't provide the wisdom we need now for our current situation. But having said that, the Bible has kind of been used and continues to inform people over a 2,000-year period. And is, I suppose one of my questions to you, Brett, is there a little bit of hubris in claiming, oh, well, it's now is the time that we won't need it any longer? And, you know, but when we look 100 years in the future, even 1,000 years in the future, I suppose I'm wondering, well, maybe the Bible will still be there, and even if lots of other things have changed around it.
So I hope people will hear in what I'm saying that I don't think the path forward is clear. I think it's very frightening. I think we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. The reason to prioritize a 2,000-year-old text is that it's lasted 2,000 years, which tells us there's something important in it. The reason to credit it less now than ever is that the rate of change is now changing at a rate that is unprecedented, right? That is frightening. Now, I would say for all of the things that we see in human culture, there's an analog in the genes that we can learn from. Genes are not all the same in terms of how quickly they change. Some of our genes are placed in a location in the genome that causes them to evolve very slowly. things on which much depends. Other things in the genome are placed in such a way that they evolve at an extremely rapid pace. What I would say is that ability to shift things in the cultural context, you may have to accept a strange definition here, but I would say sacred are things that we have placed such that they are very slow to change, that we are very reluctant to interfere with them. I would call shamanistic the alternative. So what we need to do is move towards the shamanistic, where the mutation rate on the cultural traits that we are experimenting with goes up. Not because that's a safe idea, it isn't, but because staying as we are is absolutely going to be fatal. We are simply playing with tools that are too powerful on with a population that's far too big and in a global system that is far too networked for us to continue to gamble the way we are gambling, which means we have to endure the risk of a high cultural mutation rate in order to have a chance of attaining the kind of wisdom that might get us through the next 200 years.
And are you hopeful or pessimistic that we'll achieve this, what sounds almost like a miracle the way you're putting it?
I believe there is still time, but I believe we will probably blow it.
What's your view, Alistair?
I think one of the great privileges of living at a particular moment in time is you can look back and say, oh, look, that's how they got it wrong. And of course, the difficulty is that someone might be looking back on us and saying, that's where they got it wrong. And what I find so frightening and difficult is that quite often it's very difficult to know what a future judgment is going to be because we're in the midst of the situation. Mm. And I mean, my military friends use the phrase the fog of war. What they mean is there's simply so much information, someone's confused. It's very hard actually to get it right. I just feel, you know, well, overwhelmed. Would that be a good word? That actually it is a very complex situation. And
do you feel like religion, Christianity specifically, is going to have a place in answering that huge question ultimately? I mean, for Brett, obviously, it needs to make way for something radically different. For you, I assume the person of Jesus still stands at the centre of the question.
And you're dealing with a God who, well, cares about the lilies of the field, you know, the sparrows that fall, this world as a whole, us. So in effect, I mean, the whole point of Christ's ethic is that we matter to God and this creation matters to God and we have the responsibility for this creation. And that is a frightening thought, although I hope it energizes rather than overwhelms us.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've got time for maybe two, maybe three more.
Women,
I will ask you to keep those hands up. I am anxious to have someone who's not a man asking a question. And there is a lady here who's put her hand up. Thank you.
So this is a question for Brett. I'm interested in what your perspective is on free will and moral responsibility.
Okay, so what is your perspective on free will and moral responsibility?
I am in favour of both. Okay.
I mean, it's a huge area to open up, but there is a number of people, Sam Harris, who you've obviously dialogued with, don't believe there is free will, and that does have implications for whether we can even speak of moral blame or praiseworthiness to begin with. What's your take?
Well, I should say that's a conversation I'm itching to have with Sam. I think there's a lot to be said. I'm pretty sure that if evolution is a fact, and I certainly believe that it is, that it proves that there is at least the basis for free will to exist. And I also think we all can demonstrate this in our lives. We can run relatively trivial experiments that demonstrate we must have free will. And that when somebody like Sam says that we don't, he's really talking about something else. It's a misdefinition of free will. So I do believe that it exists. And then Sam and I would agree that we have an absolute obligation to pay very close attention to moral decency, and that we have to be vigilant about it. Now, what decency is made up of is something that we have to discuss. We have serious problems with an economic system that rewards rent-seeking and externalizing harm onto others, and it results in us being, in effect, ruled by people who have become powerful through at least ignoring the destruction that they are doing. So that's a question for us to morally confront together. I don't think we're doing a good job of it, but I do think it's among the most important things that we can do, and the fact of our free will comes with a very healthy dose of responsibility that it places on our shoulders.
Anything to add to that?
No, let's take another question.
Great. Another question? Okay, let's have some more hands if we can. Let's perhaps go to some of the gentlemen. Have we got someone? Yeah, okay. Yes.
My question is for Brett. I was wondering, what's your main reason for believing that religion is fiction? What are your main points?
So the main point for why religion is essentially a fiction. Yeah. Okay, so again, it's kind of encapsulating a lot of what we've covered already, but is it simply that you see, I suppose, the evolutionary framework as being fully explanatory for why religion exists? And I suppose my question that I'd add to that one is, what could anything conceivably change your mind on that? That actually there is an actual reality and an ultimate truth in the God question or even in
Christianity? Oh, sure. And I think every scientist is morally obligated to carry a list of things that would tell them that they were wrong if they saw it. So I do maintain such a list. One thing, for example, if creatures stepped off the spaceship and were recognizably human, spoke an Earth language, were we to find biblical text encoded into a genome somewhere where there was no way somebody could have introduced it as a prank, those kinds of things would tell me I was wrong, and I would be, I'd be thrilled to accept that I was wrong, because that would mean that the situation might not be as dire as I think it is. So there's that. But I'm not claiming that religion is a fiction. And I think this is part of the problem. This is the problem I have with the new atheists, is that by caricaturing religion as a fiction, they prevent us from having the dialogue we have to have about what its strengths are likely to be and what its weaknesses are. And because I know that that conversation is not going to be an easy one, I would like us to get there quickly. I would like us to get there with generosity in our hearts so that we can get to the other side of it and get to work.
Just be interested in the some of those examples Brett gave of what might persuade him that there's a truth, objective truth in the God claim.
Yes, I think for me, I like that quote from Einstein, you know, the eternal mystery of the world is its explicability. You know, that these are meta questions, that they are really big questions about why our world works in certain ways, why we ask certain questions. And actually, for me, the reason why I believe in God is not so much in the fine details. In fact, I can stand back and there is a bigger picture which helps me to explain why we can explain. And so that's what I would locate.
But obviously for Brett, that bigger picture is the evolutionary paradigm. Why for you is that not satisfactory?
For me, if I may put it like that, is a picture. But I remember using Wigner's very famous essay, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. And he says, look, why does mathematics work so well here? No reason why it should. There has to be some bigger picture that explains that mystery. I think that's something that's helpful. But, I mean, you know, I'm very, very clear. We have, if you like, pictures or narratives that help us understand this aspect of life or that aspect of life. They're all to be welcomed. Sociologists like Christian Smith are saying we need multiple narratives to make sense of our world, and the evolutionary narrative helps us, I'm sure, in many ways, but we need other narratives for other purposes. And so for me, the question is, how do we weave these narratives together? And that to me, is a very important question to explore.
I agree with you that we have to weave these narratives together. And in fact, the evolutionary explanation is, you could attempt to explain everything in terms of particle interactions, right? It's all made of particles. They interact by rules we sort of understand. We could just come at it that way. It's going to be a long time before you figure out how a brain thinks a thought by coming at it as particles, though. You've got to step up to a higher level of emergence before you can make any progress. So we do have to integrate it. But there is a principle that I think we have to adhere to, and this one is going to be a problem, especially between religions and materialist worldviews and between religions themselves, which is all true stories must reconcile. Everything exists together in the universe. If you have two stories that don't reconcile, there's something wrong with at least one of them. So I'm up for seeing the narratives reconciled and, you know, leaning on this one because it's more helpful than some other one. But if they don't reconcile in the end, that's a problem.
And you're right. But let me give you an example which I think complexifies this. We've just been admiring George Stevenson, up there. And, you know, this is back in the Victorian age. If we'd asked George Stevenson, when did the universe begin? And being a gentleman scientist who said, well, it's always been here because that's the scientific consensus of our day. And I said, you and I don't think that anymore. And so your point you make is a good one. Narratives may not reconcile, but what happens if the narrative that we have is historically conditioned and a later generation realizes it's wrong? It's just one of these awkward questions, which I think, I mean, it doesn't say we give this up. It just says we've got to really be very alert to provisionality in some of these narratives.
So somehow I call it the agnostic box. There are certain things that you have to place in the agnostic box so that you can go backwards. If you over-instantiate your belief such that you believe that it is a fact and it is therefore the equivalent of sacred, then you become condemned to whatever errors in your model existed. So you have to be able to go backwards in case you've got it wrong.
Look, it's been a fantastic conversation. Can we give a round of applause to Alistair?
You can watch Alistair and Brett's Big Conversation in full, part one and part two, available on video at thebigconversation.show. And also, of course, from the Unbelievable YouTube channel. So that's kicked off our new season. The next Big Conversation will drop on Friday, the 4th of October. That's episode two with William Lane Craig and Sir Roger Penrose as they debate the universe. How did it get here and why are we part of it? I know there's a lot of anticipation of that one too. Thanks again to the Templeton Religion Trust for helping us to make this special series possible. And thank you for joining me. Let me tell you what's coming up next week.
You're unbelievable.
Do we live on a young or an old Earth? Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis, probably the world's best known young Earth creationist, joins me to debate with Jeff Zwierink of Reasons to Believe, the world's leading old Earth creation organization. You won't want to miss that. For now, thanks for joining me and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.